listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. We're live today. It's October 8th, and we have less than a month for the elections. So I hope everybody's ready. I think there's still a lot of people not decided, which is kind of crazy. But, you know, you always get the latecomers, like we used to say. I do have a great guest in the studio. I just wanted to bring up the fact that Hurricane Milton is heading for Florida, and they're saying it's going to leave some catastrophic losses. And right after Helene, I don't know how these people are going to handle this, but I don't even understand why people live there with all this going on, you know. And it's every year, the same thing every year, so I don't know what's going on. But we have more pressing things here, like a very special guest. We have Robin Takau-Dench, a filmmaker. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. We talked a little bit beforehand, but we're going to find out everything about your film and about you and everything. Are you originally from L.A.?
No, I'm originally from New York, but I've been in L.A. For 7 years.
New York City?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So what made you want to move here? Film? Making films?
So I was I grew up in Brooklyn, lived in Manhattan, went to college in New York.
Uh-huh.
And I was a taxi cab driver.
Oh, really?
In college, I was.
Wow. That's quite a job in New York, right?
It was a way of making supplemental income while I was production assisting on different movies.
Okay.
And what happened was the production that I was working for, they knew that I had the cab license. And so on the weekends, when they didn't want to hire a Teamster, they hired me to drive the producers around. And uh-huh. So I got to driving this guy around. And couple days into driving him around, he says to me, you know, Robin, I really like you. I want to hire you. I want to make you my assistant, you know, bring you out to L.A. I'm 20, 21, 22 at the time.
Uh-huh.
He goes, you graduated college, right? I hadn't even graduated college yet. And I just go, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm sitting in the front, like, kind of being like, this guy's just, you know, pulling my chain. And 3 months later, he sent me an offer to move out to L.A.
Uh-huh.
And I came out for work to be a Hollywood assistant at a company on Sunset Boulevard. It's, if you ever watch the opening of the Entourage, it's the tall building with this, it's the former Playboy building and HBO building.
Okay.
And that's where I worked for a year.
Wow.
And I was a terrible assistant.
Really?
Terrible assistant. I did it for a year. And I remember being like, I don't want to be setting these meetings. I want to be taking these meetings.
Right.
And so long story short, after a year, we parted ways. Still have a very good relationship.
Yeah.
But then I started making movies as a director and assistant director, and that was 10 years ago.
Wow. How did you guys meet? How did you meet him?
I met him through the movie because I was, like I said, I was his driver.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you were driving him.
I was driving him in New York, and he brought me out to L.A.
Gotcha. Okay. So, what did you take in school? Did you take film?
I studied film.
Oh, okay. What school did you go to?
Should have studied law.
Oh, yeah.
I went to NYU.
NYU?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So, you said, were your parents okay with you taking film, or did they want the lawyer thing?
My parents really wanted me to go to college.
Yeah.
And I was not a great student. I didn't have really the grades. And I think I was shocked. So I have a Japanese American mother who by all means wanted her kids. You know, I came home once and I said, Mom, I got a 92 on my test. And she goes, what happened to the other 8%? And so that kind of, you know, but she was, and I, to this day, has always been incredibly supportive mm-hmm. of me pursuing film, making films. I think she's had moments where she was like, I don't know about this, but,
yeah.
She's always been really supportive.
So she supported you from the beginning?
From the beginning.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. What about your dad?
My dad passed away when I was 21.
Oh, okay.
Or 22, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And he's missed a lot of this, unfortunately. Like, I was getting my first jobs on a set, and he was in the hospital, and we watched this movie called Margin Call. And I think I was in the credits as a production assistant, and he was really proud of me for just
yeah.
having that.
Yeah.
Because it was a sign of like, oh, this is an interest. You know, you're on your whatever pathway that leads to. But that's one thing that I unfortunately don't have is to be able to show him what I've done.
Yeah.
In that time sense.
Yeah. But, it sucks when your parent dies when you're young. You know. I mean, come on. You know.
It's we miss him greatly.
Yeah.
Especially.
Was he ill?
Or? Yeah. He passed from cancer.
Oh wow. Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. No, it's been some time.
Yeah.
And I think you know. As I said to you outside of this, I just had a daughter, and I was saying to a friend of mine who also had lost their parent, you know, mm-hmm. that there's these conversations that you don't get to have with them, and there's these
right.
questions that you want answers to,
right?
Or things that you want to show them. But I think what's so special is that in so many ways, your kids get to meet your parents through you,
right?
And so even if they never meet their grandparents, they still get a piece of them through you.
Through you, huh? Yeah. That's interesting. That's true, though. You know? Wow. Do you have any siblings, brothers or sisters?
I have a younger sister.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Where does she live now?
She was living in San Diego for 3 years. So you have the one child who makes movies, uh-huh. and then you have the lawyer on the other side.
So she's
the lawyer of the family. She is graduated from Stanford, went to Harvard, played D1 college hockey. And now works for Everytown in New York, and in an effort to curb gun violence in the U.S.
Oh, wow! It's called Everytown.
Everytown.
Oh, so she moved back from San Diego to New York.
She did.
Oh, okay. Wow. So. After San Diego, I don't know about moving to New York. Did you like New York? Did you like growing up there?
It's I describe New York as a small town. And I think the reason I say that is when you're from a place, wherever that is, mm-hmm. your world gets very small.
Yeah.
And for something, you know, there's 8 million people in New York City.
Right.
And I had a day where I literally ran into two people's mothers on the subway in the same day, in the same car, on separate trips. Uh-huh. And I just went, this is a small town.
Yeah.
You know, because, right. you know, people are like, you're running into people you haven't seen in 10 years, and they go, how are you? How's your mother? And it's, So New York is will always have a very special place in my heart.
Yeah,
like that's where
it's true. I think people never look at it as a small town, but you're right. I mean, as far as area, you know, it's not that big. You know, for 8 million people. You know?
Well, I said to my wife this morning when I drove here, I go, Tarzana's 20 miles away. You know, 20 miles is one stretch. You can go from the edge of the Bronx to Coney Island, and that's 20 miles. You've just covered the entire city.
Exactly.
So, you know.
Yeah, everything here is distances. That's for sure, you know. Because, yeah, we sometimes talk about the traffic in this town, and I don't think New York is any less terrible as far as traffic goes. But the thing is that in other places, it's not just New York and L.A. I mean, I've noticed that most big cities have a lot of traffic anyway. You know, I mean, today it's just a car culture everywhere. But in other places, it's short distances, you know, so you don't feel that much like you sit in traffic, maybe 20 minutes or something, you know. But here, I mean, if we want to go to Long Beach, it's an hour and a half from here, you know. And we go there every weekend to see family, you know. So it's 3 hours both ways. That's, you know, that's far, you know. That's a long drive. So I can see what you mean about New York and stuff. You know, I've been there several times. I love to visit it, but I don't think I could live there, you know? It's, I mean, I've always lived in cities, but New York just seems too, I don't know, too, you said small town, but as far as how many people, it's a big city, you know? And I'm like, can I really live in that congestion? You know? Because you walk on the street and you rub shoulders with people and everything, you know? But it's fun on the one hand, you know. I mean, like my wife, she would leave L.A. any moment and move to New York, you know. So it really depends on the perspective that you have, you know. But New York definitely has a lot happening, even more than in L.A. You know, L.A. goes to sleep at 9, 10 o'clock. New York, it's just starting, you know, the celebrations, you know. So
these days are definitely behind me, but I definitely, when I was in college and a little past, I remember taking a nap at 9 and then leaving my house at 1 a.m. and starting the night at 1 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
So, It's definitely a different culture. I mean, I remember I have cousins who live out in Northern California, and we were in high school, and we're about to go out to someone's house to, you know, have a night. Right. And my cousin turns to me and goes, "Who's the DD?" And I looked around and I go, "No one's ever asked me that before." And as you know, I think I just got my license, and as the resident non-driver, I said, "I'll be the designated driver. I don't mind not drinking tonight." Right. You know, but it was definitely, you know, every place is culturally a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I'm originally from Tel Aviv, and there also it's the city that never sleeps. You know. And I don't understand how people, I mean, I haven't lived there in 48 years, but I'm looking now and I'm like, how can people actually go out that late, stay up that late, and then go to work the next day, you know? Because it's just, I don't understand it, but people do it all the time, you know? And it's a way of life, you know? It's a way of life. Here, it's like you want to go to dinner. You can't find anything past 9 o'clock, only fast food, you know? When you go in the city, though, like Hollywood and stuff, you do have restaurants just stay on to, open till 11 or something, you know. That's true. But here in the valley where we live, 9 o'clock, there's nothing. The city sleeps.
It was one of the hardest things for me to adjust when I moved out
here. Really?
Was making sure that I had eaten before 8 o'clock. Because I remember it hit 9 and I go, everything's closed.
Yeah.
And I look at the fridge and I go, oh, I messed up.
That's true. Then you have to eat at home, you know. But there's a lot of great restaurants in this town, that's for sure.
We
keep finding new ones all the time. And New York also, culinary, you know, in abundance, you know. So very cool. So
I often say culturally, because people ask, having lived in both places, what are the differences? And I'll say, well, the fresh produce is better in California.
Oh, yeah.
But the tap water is better in New York.
Oh, is it really?
It's very good.
Yeah, here people you have to use bottles for your water, you know. And it costs so much money, you know. I mean, you know, they spend so much money on designing the bottles that they have to charge you a lot just for the water, you know. It's crazy. It really is crazy. So now, you said you came from Venice. Is that the part of town where you live in?
Yes, we live in Venice now.
Really?
We moved in December.
That's a cool place to live, huh?
It is a cool place to live. I think it was sort of a bucket list.
It's a beach town, for those of you who don't know.
We were in Highland Park right before, and we had roof rats.
Roof rats?
Yeah, so my wife was 7 months or 8 months pregnant, and we had this, like, they weren't in the apartment, but they were in the ceiling.
Wow.
And you hear them every morning at 7 a.m., and so we just were like, before the baby's born, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And we found this little bungalow that's like right by the beach, and we were like,
wow,
that'd be nice.
Cool. So. That's a lot of people's dream, you know. I mean, Venice has a lot happening there, you know. It's like when you visit LA, you've got to go there. A bunch of crazy people, weird people, but interesting. It's very interesting there, you know. Always smells like weed. But strong smell. It's not just, you know, everybody smokes there. And you have characters that have been there for decades, you know, and it's just a fun place to be. And I can't imagine living there, but I think you you really picked a nice place, you know. I mean, are you guys close to the beach, actually?
Yeah, we're about
you can walk to
20-minute walk.
Oh, okay. Not bad. Not bad at all. You know, people wonder why it's called Venice. Did you ever see the canals there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they actually have canals there. And some people live here for many years. They don't even know.
It's pretty.
But it's very pretty. You know, houses on the canals. The small canals, of course, nothing like in Italy. But people live there, and they're small canals. People have boats and stuff, and there's a lot of places to walk there and things like that. So it's very peaceful, very serene.
So when I first moved to LA from New York, someone goes, "Where do you want to live?" Mm-hmm. And I looked at him like he was crazy. And I go, "As close to the beach as humanly possible."
Yeah.
You know, I think for New Yorkers, it's such it's something we don't have.
Right.
We don't have the access to the beach. We don't have the access to the water in the same way.
Right.
And so I think it's a real draw.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to stay there permanently.
Right.
But it is nice for the meantime. And it's nice also to have to be in an area where we can walk with a stroller. And
yeah, that's true, yeah. So you're a new father, of, relatively speaking, right? You said 8 months?
8 months.
8 months, wow. Well, this changed your life forever, though, right? I mean, the baby is born, and everything changes.
Yes.
I've got two grown kids, I remember, you know. So it's not for the worse, it's just it's different.
It's different.
It's different. You have to change your lifestyle completely, you know.
And I'm up earlier a lot.
Yeah. I know, that happens.
I can't be going out at 1 a.m. anymore.
Yeah.
I could, but I would seriously regret waking up in the morning.
Yeah.
So,
when did you meet your wife?
We met in college.
Oh, in college.
We
back
met
in
college,
York.
And but we started dating out here, and we've just been, you know, we've been together since 2012.
So, but did you move together or
no? We actually moved separately. We had different jobs.
Oh, really?
We actually we started off as roommates.
Really?
We had been pals in college, and we were both assistants at different companies, mm-hmm. and just sort of hit it off.
Wow. So you both moved here, but it's separately, right?
Separately.
And then you guys connected here.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, especially like with the roommate, because you try to keep it platonic, you know, when your roommates are there. But then, you know, deep inside, you're like, I like her, you know.
It lasted about 3 months, if that. But we've been together since, and it's been really,
wow,
really,
that's
really,
nice, really story. Great, yeah. That's nice. Very cool. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, so you moved here when? How long ago did you move here?
So I moved here in 2012, mm-hmm. and then we moved back to New York actually in 2014, and then we've been here since 2019.
I see.
So we've,
oh, 5 years.
But 5 years.
5 years, yeah. Right, yeah. And did you make any films in New York before you moved here?
I've been making movies since I was like 16.
Really?
15. Yeah, I've just kind of like went like little cameras with friends, you know. The first like real film I made after college was a movie called Tadaima. It's about a Japanese American family coming back home from internment in the 1940s.
Uh-huh.
And we made that in 2000 and that came out in 2015.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked as an assistant director on feature films like After Yang and The Ultimate Playlist of Noise and a movie called Ted K. And I did that pretty much all the way through the pandemic, up until the pandemic. So from like 2014 till 2020. And I was making, you know, movies on the side. So I was like, right. You know, working on these feature films. And then when the job was over, I'd go off and make a short film. So I'd made a political thriller that was based in New York, and we shot in Times Square for that one, which was fun.
Uh-huh.
I've done a sci-fi thriller with Sarita Chowdhury that was in 2019,
mm-hmm.
and so I've been able to shoot in both places. Yes,
that's nice. And those were short films that you made, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The current film Fireline is also a short film, and we'll find out all about it and stuff. So in college, you had to make a movie, right?
Yeah, no, I
they make you one.
So in college, I had an interesting relationship with NYU, but I made a handful of short films, but I didn't want to make a film at the time, and this may have been not the way to do it, but I didn't want to make a film with the institution itself.
Uh-huh.
So I waited till I graduated
to
make my sort of quote unquote thesis film.
Uh-huh.
My thesis film was, or thesis I put in quotations,
right?
Was shot out of without the institution.
Oh, okay. And that was the one with the internment camps?
That's right.
I see. Wow. How did the idea come about for you?
I think that's the story. That's one of those stories that I had wanted to do for a really long time. It's a story that I grew up with. It was something that was very much a part of my family, my family history, and yet it was never sort of taught to me in school, especially on the East Coast. Japanese American internment was not something that was really covered.
Right.
And so it was a desire to put something into a visual medium that could be referenced and referred to and reviewed and played and shared. And the movie's now part of what's called Densho, which is the Japanese American Legacy Project. Mm-hmm. And it is early virality, if you will. It's like a 15-minute slow short film that
that's cool.
got thousands and thousands of views on with absolutely no marketing.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very nice.
You know, so it's been out there for a bit. And it's what's so touching is people will meet people along the way and they'll say, oh, I saw your short film. And it's mm-hmm. just like, that's something that I never had would have ever expected.
Yeah. So, tell people, what's the name of the film so they can see it?
The name of the movie is called Tadaima, T-A-D-A-I-M-A, and it means I'm home in Japanese.
Oh, I see. Okay. And where can you watch this, like on YouTube or something?
So it's on Vimeo. It's on Vimeo. Vimeo. It's on my website, robintakaodench.com. But it was on different outlets. It had been licensed by different companies. And they had it up behind a paywall. And I said, you know what? I don't want this movie to be – I don't want to charge people to see this.
Right,
so
right.
So I took it back and just made it available for everyone online.
Yeah. Very nice. Very cool. So you got a lot of views?
Fair amount.
That's good. That's a good feeling. When you know people admire your work and they actually take the time to check it out.
So I'm hoping that this next one has a good run. You know, I've done a number of movies, but the ones I'm most proud of are definitely Tadaima and then Fireline. So we have a 10-year space in between. These movies, but I think that Fireline has really captured something special and unique. And I think that's what we hope to do when we make a movie is do something that hasn't been done before.
Yeah. Interesting. So the new movie is Fireline. And this is a short film. How long is the film?
14 minutes.
14. And I know, I understand that short movies can be, what, up to like 29 minutes or something or something like that, right? But, and also, you know, we've interviewed a lot of short filmmakers because Catherine sends us a lot of great filmmakers like yourself. And by the way, you know, when she's known for having clients who won the Oscar and nominated for the Oscar, so you're in good company, you know? You're doing very well. And I understand you were in a couple of festivals. Mm-hmm. Which ones?
So the movie played at Tribeca, premiered uh-huh. at Tribeca in June.
That's in New York, right?
That's in New York. Okay. So that was actually a lot of fun because it was able to, you know, have a hometown screening,
right?
See friends and family, and premiere at a place that is a festival that I've been going to since I was a young kid.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a very special experience to be able to do.
Yeah, was it well received?
Well received, standing ovation, the whole
really?
Thing. Oh, yeah, no, it was you could there was so whenever you watch a movie for the first time with an audience, you're kind of like, is this working? And I just remember like 5 minutes in, like when they're off to go fight the fire, you could just feel in the room like the air is being sucked out of it, like there's like this tension. And then when it was over, it was huge applause. It was they clapped when the movie ended and they clapped when the credits were over, so that was a good sign. We got two applause.
Yeah, for sure.
No, but it was
was this entirely your film? You wrote it, you produced, you directed. Yeah. Have you ever acted in a film, or you like just be behind the camera?
I prefer being behind the camera. I've been asked, but I've never really done it.
Yeah. You do what you're good at, what you love to do. Yeah.
Certainly more comfortable with.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the plot of the film. The film is called Fireline, and I found it to be a very interesting topic that people don't really necessarily think about much. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the plot.
So the film's about an inmate firefighter in California who learns that his parole has been rejected, and so he's trying to call his daughter on her birthday just to wish her a happy birthday at the very same time that his crew is going out to fight a fire.
Uh-huh.
And what a lot of people don't know, especially outside of California, is that up to 30% of Cal Fire is supplemented by prison labor.
Really?
And it's a program that exists since the 1940s mm-hmm. to And it's a year-round program, so people are, you know, they're cutting line, they're doing fire prevention, and in every major fire, excuse me, in every major fire, there is a bunch of guys out in Orange who are on the line doing the exact same work as Cal Fire, Forestry, and they're being paid $5 to $8 a day versus $50 to $80 an hour. And so it is when I got the prompt to make the movie, you know, the production company was looking for themes that reflected, quote unquote, the future of work.
Okay.
And I, pulling on my Asian American background, was very inspired by the history of Chinese American railroad workers, history of Irish indentured servants, and an entire labor system that stems from American slavery. Okay. And then what does that look like in a modern day?
Yeah.
And so armed with this sort of desire to reflect a modern exploitation of labor, but also include the climate, because I had, you know, I was in New York last summer and in July, and I don't know if you remember this in the news, but there was a day where the sky went bright, vibrant orange. It was like the color of these chairs.
Really?
Wow. And it was
From fires?
It was a forest fire in Canada.
And oh, yeah, that I remember. Okay.
And the smoke had come down all the
way to New York. Yeah, a little closer to the
And back. It was a moment where, regardless of your feeling on climate change, we are now living in a new, we have a new relationship with our environment and with our climate. And so I wanted to capture something that reflected this sort of new reality while also showcasing the work of a group of men that you don't typically see.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the origins of this. And then I got an incredible cast with Bobby Soto, who's been in The Tax Collector, Narcos, Flamin' Hot, Joshua Caleb Johnson, who's in one of my favorite television shows that I've ever seen, The Good Lord Bird, which is about the abolitionist John Brown. He's also an MLKX. Who's now become a really dear friend of mine, Fabian Alomar, who was a former pro skateboarder in the 90s. He's also in Flamin' Hot. He's in This Fool, and he's in Mayans. And Fabian comes from a history of Fabian himself was incarcerated for a number of years. And he's so open about his story and his journey from a skateboarder to inmate to now actor, and has been instrumental in keeping the piece authentic and being an ally to the project. And so now we're trying to do further outreach for the film within incarcerated and formerly incarcerated communities to bring the film to a new audience.
Right. How did you find out that there were actually inmates fighting fires?
I think it's one of those things that I knew about. Like I said, a lot of my extended family lives in Northern California, and every single one of them at some point has had to leave their homes on account of fire or smoke. I have family friends who've lost their homes up in further north in Shasta County. I think it's just something I've always been aware of, that one thing I did not know a lot about was how you fight fire. How does fire, because, you know, especially if you're from a major urban city, you know, we're used to firefighters with like black jackets and axes and these outer spaceman face masks and these hard helmets. And like, you know, forest fire guys are much more nimble. They're going out in much lighter jackets. There's no tanks, there's no face masks. It's just like a shroud over your face. And so there's a lot less protection to do this work. And they're not using water in the same way. As opposed to a traditional firefighter as we know it in a city, they come with a ladder and hook, and they're spraying the fire down with hoses. Whereas forest fire prevention is often done by what's called cutting line. And this is where the title fire line comes from. And you're essentially clearing brush and roots. So if the forest is part of your fuel, you're trying to cut the amount of fuel And so the fire has nowhere to expand once it hits the edge of the line.
Right.
And that's something that we show in the movie of how it's done.
So that's the main way they fight forest fires? And also with the airplanes, right? With the, they drop all
they
the,
drop water from airplanes. So from a – and I don't want to come off as an expert because, again, I'm a pseudo-expert having learned about all this in the last 2 years and you know, inundating myself with as much knowledge as possible. But, you know, the greater force of fire prevention comes from seeing where the fire is moving to and trying to cut off its source.
I see.
So you're trying to it's going to burn. Mm-hmm. You're trying to mitigate the amount it burns and isolate the fire from further spreading.
I see. Kind of control it. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Contain it for the most part. Yeah.
But it's been a really interesting film to make and to be a part of and to explore, and with any luck we'll get to make another one.
Yeah. And I mean in 14 minutes, that's a lot to include in such a short time, right?
There was a lot of things that did not make the cut, you know. Yeah. I had a very strict budget, I had a very strict time limit I could capture, and so there were pages and pages and pages of information that could have gone into the film, and so we did a very intentional job of keeping it focused on the emotional journey of this character and showing as opposed to explaining. Mm-hmm. of how the work is done.
Right.
And the dangers that come with it.
Yeah.
And something I should also mention as well, death rates are relatively low. People do die every year doing this. But the injury rate amongst inmate firefighters is 8 times higher than that of a traditional wildland firefighter.
Why is that?
It's a multitude of – they only get 2 weeks of training, so it's lower training. And at the end of the day, you're still in prison. So even though you are fighting fire, there's less agency as to what you – like you can't just walk away.
Right.
So if someone says, hey, you got to go do this, you stay out there until it's done.
Right.
And so
do they do this by choice or are they forced to do this?
So it is a volunteer program.
Okay.
And this is where I think the gray line, the areas of gray really exist within this work. You know, the film had an alternative opening. We actually didn't make the final cut, but the opening of the film was a social worker standing in a group of the firefighters asking, like, why do you want to do this? And the reasons, and this is all true, the food's better.
Yeah.
You know, firefighter, you know, if you work in the fire camp program, you get real food. You get barbecues for days, like, because they need the guys to be physically fit.
Right.
And have the energy to do the work. So they're served real food.
Right.
As far as prison jobs are concerned, well, you know, we'll look at $5 to $8 a day as an exploitation rate. That is significantly more than any other job that you can have in prison. So whether you're in textiles or doing agriculture, those jobs pay cents per day.
Yeah, wow.
And so getting that extra, you know, $5 to $8, while again is very, very little,
yeah,
is still significantly more than you can make in any other prison job.
Right.
There are benefits as far as for every day that you're on, so not in camp, but on the line actually fighting a fire. For every day you're out there,
uh-huh,
you get a day off your sentence. So it's time in, time out.
Oh, okay.
And so that's a benefit. There are vocation advantages as far as learning a skill set that you can, you know, I think people are really proud to fight fire. It's like one of those jobs where, like, you feel like you're contributing to society. So
yeah,
as far as an individual who has been shunned from society and said you can't exist here, it empowers you to sort of say, I'm contributing to society, even if society doesn't want me as part of it.
Yeah.
And then finally, as one person said, I'd rather be out here than doing 23 hours in solitary confinement. So,
yeah.
I think as far as volunteering is concerned, I want to say it's not just because, oh, this is such a great thing. It's more just prison's so terrible,
yes,
that people do anything to get out.
Anything, yeah. Now, did you have to include actual fire in the movie? Did you actually show them?
So when I the movie has a 5-minute firefighting sequence.
Oh, it does.
And the producers, when they were offering me the job, they said, they go, "How are you going to do this?" And I go, "Oh, it's easy. It's easy. We're just going to use we're going to use light and we're going to use smoke, and then we'll do it all in post, and we'll add the fire in post because you know we don't want to start a fire."
Right.
And then I get off the call and I go, "I don't know, maybe." But that's what we did. You know, I had seen this movie. I had seen two movies by Sam Mendes. One was James Bond, Skyfall, and the other was 1917. And in those films, there are buildings that are on buildings that are on fire. And how they shot it was they had these panels that lined up next to the building, and they would project light as if it was a heat source, as if it was fire.
Uh-huh.
And then they would just paint it out in post and create the flames.
I see.
And so that's what we did.
Really? Wow.
And my cinematographer's dad saw the movie. And he looks at him and goes, "You know, Ming, it's not worth it." He goes, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "You don't need to put your life at risk to make these movies. You're too close to the flames. It's too dangerous."
Right.
And he goes, "Dad, it's not real. It's all fake." And he just like was.
Whoa.
So, and you asked me about awards. You know, we won Best VFX at Holly Shorts a couple weeks ago. And I think it speaks to the talent. We had an incredible visual effects supervisor named Celeste Leiser, who I just want to shout out on the show, because she single-handedly did the post effects. But combined with practical smoke, light, and then post VFX on the flames, it really creates a sense of real flames. And I think we did a really good job capturing that.
So and that's pretty. I mean, that's pretty unusual for a short film. To get so much into effects and things like that, right? Because I know usually it's low budget; it's mostly talking and things like that. A couple of characters, maybe. But you actually went all out and created the situations and went to and used special effects and post and all that stuff. Very interesting. Yeah, because that's why I was asking. Because how do you shoot with fire? You know, I mean, my God, you know. It's like if you remember Backdraft, which you probably do, I was wondering, how did they do all that? You know, it was amazing. But
Backdraft is all practical flame.
Yeah,
all
right?
Real flame.
They didn't have a lot of special effects back then for fire.
And so, you know, and actually I watched Backdraft before shooting this because I was kind of like, you know, if that is the largest version of how to shoot flame, what, you know, what can we do and how do we pull it off? And it speaks to the time period because, again, this was the mid-90s when they were shooting that movie.
Right.
And so a lot of it is like – and I have – you know, with my production background, I have a lot of experience. I've experienced, quote-unquote, burning down buildings. So I've done fire scenes before. And when you use practical flame, even on a small scale, what you can do is you take what's called a flame bar. You put that in front of the camera so there's foreground flame. And then they have what's called pots. And the pots have this kerosene in it. And so you'll place the pot strategically behind certain objects, and so it'll look like all this stuff is on fire. But, you know, if you're looking down the lens, you can make it seem like all this stuff is on flame with just three little fires. But for Backdraft, I mean, that was a lot of gasoline they used.
Yeah. Wow.
So very different approach.
They probably used a lot of real firefighters too, right?
That was a big movie. So they used it all.
Yeah. That's amazing.
I had a teacher in film school when he goes, and this is before Avatar, but he said, what's the biggest movie you can think of? And he just writes Titanic on the whiteboard or on the chalkboard. And he goes, so this movie's obviously a Titan, and so he just crosses out the word Titanic. We're a small movie, and we have to be cheap, so you can't afford the sea. So he crosses out the sea, and he goes, and then all that's left is like the little dot above the eye, and he circles it and goes, "That's you. That's your short film."
Yeah.
And I think about that too. So you know, when we did this, you know, I was thinking, well. We're not going to be Titanic, but maybe we get, instead of just the circle above the eye, we'll get the whole eye.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we intentionally made a really ambitious movie.
Yeah, it sounds ambitious. Now, let's give credit to some of the cast. I think you mentioned a couple of people before, but Why don't you go ahead and tell us who starred in the film?
So Bobby Soto stars as the lead actor. Again, so Bobby, you know, in searching for the leading actor for this, I really wanted someone who could, you could see it immediately, like, you're just like, that's our guy. You just, like, gravitate to them. It's like this sort of je ne sais quoi is, like, what makes the leading man. And Bobby has this sort of rough exterior, but he's got this, like, tenderness and soulfulness to him. The moment you see him, you're it's like a magnetic energy. And I had seen an interview, and I find I've now done this several times with films, is that I'm always curious to see how people exist when they're not acting. Mm-hmm. And what do they think about? What do they talk about? How does their mind work? And Bobby had wrote and starred in a movie called Mundo, which is about a young man who takes the fall for his family and does time for his family. And, you know, part of Bobby's family history is that his family has 54 years of incarceration behind him. So even though he has never done time, mm-hmm. He has been tangentially a part of this for many years. And so he has I kind of just knew that, like, maybe this movie would appeal to him and it would speak to him. And, you know, something Fabian has said, Bobby has said, it is like, when you do time, your family does time.
Yeah.
And I thought that was such a powerful line or anecdote to sort of, especially for a story that's about a man trying to call his daughter on her birthday. You know, it's about fear of missing things.
Yeah.
And so this theme of when you do time, your family does time, was just something that I think that really spoke to both he and I. And so, you know, we met. We had lunch together, and halfway through the conversation, Bobby just reaches over the table and goes, "I'm in."
Oh yeah.
And so we formed this partnership about making this movie, and it's one of the proudest relationships I've had between a director and an actor. And so I think he brings something to the film that was sort of we hoped to get on the page, but with Bobby, I think you're really along for the ride, and something people have said to me over and over again is how he breaks your heart.
Wow. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie.
I hope you like it. I think
I think I will.
It's a thrilling film.
It sounds very, did you get to film in the prison at all?
So we tried.
Yeah.
We tried. We reached out to, I sent an email to, CDCR and asked them if we could use their facilities, and they said no.
Really?
but I think that's part of it, right? You turn over every stone, you look under every log, you just sort of say, what, you know. So I'll often say when I'm making a movie, the worst thing that, if you're asking for something, the worst thing that they can say is yes.
Really?
Because if you ask for something and they say no, well, that's exactly where I was 30 seconds ago. So, like, now I can just move on.
Yeah.
But if someone says yes, now you have to be accountable.
That's true.
Now you have to live up to the expectation. You have to say, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to deliver this. I'm going to.
Right.
Now you have to actually do it.
Right.
And so that's why I say the worst thing someone can say is yes.
That's true. Yeah.
Because again, if they say no, like, okay.
Yeah. Who are some of the supporting cast in the film?
So again, it's Joshua Caleb Johnson, Fabian Alomar, Darren Cooper, and then we had a bunch of smaller appearances. Like, so there's a supporting cast of about 10 other people who just kind of pop up. But, you know, one thing that we really wanted to do as far as authenticity of the picture is hire actors who were also incarcerated. So almost half the cast, especially in the ensemble of the supporting roles, and a lot of the actors that you see in the prison scenes are formerly incarcerated.
I see.
And you asked about the location. The location we shot in was, I found this spot on Google Maps of all places, and it's about 10 minutes north of Sylmar, up in the Angeles National Forest. Mm-hmm. and it's currently a Korean Christian like summer camp.
Okay.
But it was formed, the estate and the grounds formerly belonged to Cecil B. DeMille. It was his country home. And so when you get there, there's like this old gate, but it was, you know, again, the producer's like, how are you going to do this? Oh, we're going to find a location that has like the prison, and then it'll have a forest in the backyard. And I get off the call and go, maybe. and it did. You know, someone said, this is a summer camp? Oh, this is a miserable looking summer camp. But I think that's what I was looking for. I was looking for something that was kind of older brick, had fencing, something that could resemble an institution. And again, it's a non-conventional prison, but it is still a prison. And like I said, we got really lucky with our location.
Yeah, very cool. Did you have any – who did you have helping you behind the scene?
I had two great producers in Fiona Hardingham and Danny Sanchez Lugo. And they were just, making films is really hard. And so producing films is really hard. And it's really thankless. And I just want to shout out Danny and Fiona for being troopers on this whole thing. And, you know, one thing I always say a lot, especially with producers, is there's two avenues. You can have the path of least resistance, or you can look to go the distance.
Right.
And I knew from the get-go that these two wanted to go the distance.
Yeah.
And that they weren't always looking for the easy way out or the first idea, we'll do that. It was, all right, well, that's one idea. What's the next idea? What's the better idea? What's the best idea? And then what's the idea that we can afford, achieve? And so it was you're always trying to solve a puzzle.
Right.
And it's not just a simplistic of like, well, that's the obvious answer. It's like, okay, well, if that's the obvious answer, what's the not obvious answer?
Yeah.
And so I credit them a lot. And then the other sort of soul warrior through this whole thing was my cinematographer, Mingju, who had made a film with these particular producers the year before and was like, you should do this. You should do this. You should meet.
Yeah.
But between my cinematographer, my costume designer, Claire Mildred, my production designer, Kimberly Metella, my visual effects supervisor, Celeste Leiser, there was many, many people along the way who were instrumental into making this movie. You know, initially we were going to have 8 firefighters you can't get the prison costumes or the prison outfits.
Uh-huh.
It belongs to CDCR, and our costume designer made them from scratch. And she goes, well, this is what it's cost to make. And so we were like, okay, we're going to go from 8 and then go down to 3. So, and we were able to work into the story of like, why is there 3 as opposed to why is there 8? But, the amount of time, energy, work, commitment, experience, creativity and passion that went into this, across the board was stunning. And I think that's why the film came out the way it did, is because so many people worked so hard.
Yeah, great teamwork.
Really, really great teamwork.
How did you meet the producers?
So Fiona and I had done a program together called a Film Independence Project Involved. And so we were part of a fellowship 2 years ago. And while we didn't work together in that particular program, we had known each other. Oh, the other person I want to mention is my editor, Skylar Zhang, who brought that thing to life. But this was an excuse for us to sort of work together. When we first met, I said to her, I go, listen, I usually like to say that I'm really easy to work with. And then it looked her dead in the eye. I go, I'm not easy to work with. but I'm going to work really hard.
Right.
And I'm not when I say I'm not easy to work with, it's not because I'm mean or nasty or this or that. It's just I'm looking to go hard. I'm not looking for the easy out. I'm looking for the how do we maximize this experience? Because you only get the amount of time you get to make a movie is the prep, the shoot, which is And then they post, and that's it. And then it's over. You can't, yeah. you can watch it again, but you can't change it. You can't touch right. it. And so let's take the time we have and just run, sprint as fast as we can until our lungs hurt.
Right.
She called me up a couple days later. She goes, I don't like it that you said that you're hard to work with. Don't say that. And I said, okay. But, it not only became a really good working relationship, it became a really good friendship. And so, that was sort of how that forge was made.
Sounds good. Well, Robin, thank you so much for joining us. How can people find you, the film?
So, the film is playing on October 24th at 3:00 at Newport Beach Film Festival in a couple weeks.
Oh, nice.
You can find me, Robin Takao Dench, RobinTakaoDench, if you can remember all that, .com.
We'll have it written on the website so you guys can remember.
And or just Google. Yeah. But Sam, thank you so much for having me and talking about the movie.
Of course. And I wish you a lot of success with the film, continued success with it. Are you guys nominated for the Oscar or anything?
So we're eligible for the Academy Awards right now. Uh-huh. The film is entering voting.
Uh-huh.
And you know, fingers crossed. So if you're an Oscar voter, vote for Fireline.
There you go, Fireline it is. All right, Robin, thank you again. All the best to you. Everybody, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.